turned when the judge sided with the state's counterappeal, and Rob had stood by while his father was transferred to Trenton State once again, a year and a half after Rob and Carl had walked out with him in December 1997. These labors, duties, paychecks, and heartbreaks were 6 months of Rob's life, and I knew little about most of them. What I did know was that the tentativeness with which I had first regarded him had faded, if not into total comfort, then at least close enough. I knew that Rob had also, beginning with fall reading week and progressing through the winter and spring of freshman year, become one of the leading drug dealers on campus. By this time, midway through our second year, I would typically come home to a mirthful tribal circle carved out of his bedroom, a safe haven for misfits and trendsetters alike to pass around a joint and download their days. Rob, presiding with his trademark grin and barbed bon mot. Never before had I found him as I had now, alone and miserable and sitting wide awake in the dark. "Yo, Rob," I said. He barely raised his reddened, watery eyes. "Everything cool?" He mumbled some ambiguous syllable. "You want the lights back off, or?" With true, unadulterated vitriol, he replied, "I just hate all these entitled motherfuckers." He was talking more to himself than to me, as I was more or less one of those entitled motherfuckers. In other words, the majority of the Yale student body, clusters of them now passing back and forth in front of our first floor window with their books and winter coats, the Ivy League version of the hustlers walking Chapman Street at night. He picked up a physical chemistry textbook from the floor and began to read, and I retreated into my bedroom to spend a few hours in the Congo with Marlowe in search of Kurtz. Aside from the audible friction of a page being turned, Rob gave little suggestion of life unfolding in the next room. After a time, the chemistry textbook thumped closed, and the TV came on. One of his beloved kung fu movies. I put my own book down and deferred the essay I was to start writing tonight in order to join him. He was watching a bootleg VHS of Snake in the Monkey's Shadow, which he'd brought back from his last trip home along with a gallon-sized Ziploc packed with dry marijuana and orange rinds. The film, grainy and nonsensical, definitely not worth the $2 he'd paid for it, lightened his mood to the point that he asked me if it was okay for him to smoke. I nodded and he lit up. He looked older and rougher when inhaling a joint, pinching it between thumb and index finger with the live end cupped in his palm, breathing in with fast intensity and out with painstaking slowness. Apropos of nothing, he said, "So, you want to know what happened?" The incident had occurred in the dining hall where Rob worked 5 nights a week. A group of guys on the crew team, that association implying that they were white rich and had landed at Yale by way of elite New England boarding schools, had stood up to leave without bussing their trays to the window 10 paces away. Rob had told them, courteously he wanted me to be sure, to take care of their tray so he could wipe off the table, which itself had been left a crummy, puddled mess. The guys had mumbled something about being in a rush and kept walking, leaving plates heaped with half-eaten food for Rob to dispose of. They probably hadn't realized that he was a student. They failed to say thank you to him or any other staff workers on their way out. Each rendered detail accumulated in the telling and restoked Rob's ire. The disrespect, the avoidance of eye contact, the smirks, the preppy clothes, the slovenly mess, the food haphazardly wasted. The fact that these guys had no doubt forgotten the interaction the moments they'd passed by Jacinta and exited the dining hall to begin their nights, a keg party at the Zeta Psi house, presumably, since it was Thursday and that was what the crew team did on Thursdays. And Rob in his starched white uniform and with a hairnet over his cornrows had stood over the remnants of their dinners and watched them leave. Beneath the tall portraits of prominent alumni, the dining hall was bright with talk and laughter, rendering him helpless to do what he wanted to do, what most any of his neighborhood friends from Newark would have done, pin each of them face down on the hardwood floor and stomp the backs of their heads until their teeth popped out. Curbing, a process he had refused to explain to his mother, but that he described in detail to me now, including the satisfying squelching sound of teeth relinquishing attachment to gums. I didn't ask whether this portrait came from first-hand experience. He couldn't even call them what later, to me, he would, motherfuckers. All he could do was bust the three trays so that Jacinta or Roslyn or Jimmy, his colleagues and friends, full-time dining hall employees, wouldn't have to. Then he'd put his fist through the wall in the dish room. He showed me the resultant swelling and three knuckles. I asked if he'd get in trouble for that, and he replied that one of the cooks had promised to patch up the hole with plaster before the manager showed up so Rob wouldn't get fired. I thought the story ended there, but Rob kept going, protracting these events into the future. His desire to find the guys, get them off campus, and carry out retribution away from the faculty overseers. Blue-lit emergency phones and campus police who maintained the pervading atmosphere of complete safety, even invincibility. Though he didn't say so in words, he seemed intent on proving to himself and to them that no one was invincible, that Yaley or not, anyone could and should be held to account for the kind of person he was. I got the sense that where he'd grown up, this wasn't a matter of etiquette or debate. "You can't do that, Rob," I said, and he looked at me, chagrined, his face saying, "Why the hell not?" My answer, "I mean, you just can't." I know," he finally said. "What, you thought I was serious?" In fact, I had known he was. I was still struggling to equate the irritating but unremarkable encounter he'd described. I had doubtlessly forgotten to bust my own tray once or twice, though I didn't admit that now, with the profound anger still coursing through him a few hours and a few joints later. I felt guilty for being unable to do so, for lacking the empathy required to connect a careless prep school slight to a fundamental flaw in the social construct in which we lived. All I said was, "That sucks, dude." He shook his head and smiled for the first time that night, a smile approaching the broad, remarkable grin that had come to characterize him on campus. He knew I could never understand, and he was kind enough not to hold my sheltered obliviousness against me. This had become the rhythm of our friendship at Yale. He would share with me the smallest fragment of his world and then step back into the whole of mine. We watched the movie's climactic fight, a murderous ninja sensei being avenged by his protege. My mind drifted back to my English paper and the track meet this weekend and some girl who wasn't emailing me back. His mind went somewhere else, a place I couldn't access. A struggle rooted in a youth he never spoke of, a struggle he seemed to feel, with a possessiveness closely related to pride, was his alone to bear. He didn't hide his drug dealing anymore, and he conducted much of it in our room. A few times a night, there would be a knock on the door, and a student would murmur, "Hey," and slink past me into Rob's room, where he would execute their commerce via the lower right-hand drawer of his desk. If the buyer was a friend, he or she might stay and smoke with him. Some nights these gatherings would grow to four or five people who fit themselves in as best they could, sitting hip to hip on his bed on stacks of textbooks, on the heavy blank trunk in which he kept his bongs, weed, and ledgers. I didn't know where he hid his cash or how much he actually made, only that cash was all he used to buy anything, though he bought very little. One of these purchases was a desktop computer, which a grad student had dug out of a lab closet and sold to him for $200. We'd come to college during the time when everyone began owning computers. For those who couldn't afford one, Pearson College maintained a dark, usually empty room of desktops in the basement, known as the computer ghetto. Rob had spent many hours down there, and he was proud of his new machine. He cleared space for it on a desk in the common room and said we were all welcome to use it. He quickly found that the model was at least 6 years out of date, incapable of supporting basic word processing programs, let alone Excel and the Internet. When he also learned that the grad student, who had made it out to Rob as though he were buying it from the biology department, had actually pocketed the money himself, Ty and I spent a full afternoon talking him out of the inclination to beat up the guy. He ended up propping the computer in our non-functioning fireplace as some sort of totem to his naivete. With this computer screen watching, like our version of the eyes of T.J. Eckelberg, the mixing of people from all walks of life that university pamphlets displayed in glossy photos but was rarely observed on campus manifested itself in his stoner circles. Blacks, Hispanics, grungy kids wearing hemp hoodies and beards, thespians and athletes, an Australian with long blonde hair who was famous for walking around barefoot, they all gravitated toward Rob Peace's room, the place where judgments were few, laughter was steady, and weed was always available. "Don't you worry about living with a drug dealer?" friends would often ask. Coolly, as if I had the faintest clue as to what I was talking about, I would shrug and smile and say, "It's just Rob, it's what he does. He must need the money, and he would never be dumb about it." Honestly, I was more worried about the way he cracked his joints every afternoon after water polo practice in a disturbing ritual. He would drop his bag and stand in the middle of the room, then point his face to the ceiling and arch his back grotesquely such that his torso was nearly parallel to the floor. Starting with his top vertebra, the bones popped one by one down his spine. He would twist at the hips, and the left socket would sound off, then the right. He brought each arm across his chest and pulled with the opposite hand to accomplish the same with his shoulders. Knees, ankles, elbows, wrists, and for the finale, the machine gun pop-pop-pop of his fingers. I wasn't worried about him getting busted for marijuana. I was worried about him dislocating his hip or ending up hunchbacked. Since he never seemed to spend any of the money he made, I figured he must be using it for tuition or saving up for graduate school or helping Jackie, whom I hadn't seen again since we'd moved in a year and a half before, but whose aloofness still stayed with me. The four of us had decided easily to stay together as roommates after freshman year, an agreement consummated with guyish head nods and shrugs. But Ty had a serious girlfriend, Adana, the daughter of a wealthy Los Angeles gastric surgeon who specialized in stapling stomachs. Rob called her Predator for her long, thin dreadlocks and gently mocked her wealth. She had drawn a single room in the lottery, so Ty effectively lived with her. Dan had fallen in with the popular crowd, kids who found a way to party each night of the week and were fond of saying, 90% of what you learn in college happens outside the classroom. And so, in our dorm room, Rob and I tended to be alone, quietly coexisting for the most part, sometimes talking about girls, football, food. Bullshitting, he called what we did fondly, and we did it all the time. Though we spoke about nothing much at all, this was how I learned about the football games of his youth. The afternoon with his father listening to a Yankees game on a stranger's front stoop, Jackie and his grandparents, and Victor, and the deep role that marijuana played in his life. I smoke a blunt, and I can hang out or study or just chill, he said dazedly, and it's like nothing matters, not even time, and for a couple of hours I can just be. He once looked up from across the room and said, "You know what I like about you, Jeff?" Having been curious about this for some time but somehow afraid to ask, I asked, "Because it's all good with you. You just read your books and write your stories and don't give a damn." A low-level pride coursed through me upon hearing his observation. In a world where defining yourself felt unnecessarily complicated most of the time, I thought that being all good was a pleasingly simple way to do it. By virtue of proximity, I felt more involved in his life than I ever would have predicted during the first months of college. When he and Zena had broken up, after my initial relief had subsided, I'd consoled him with comments like, "She's about to graduate anyway. The long-distance thing never works." The incident in the dining hall was the second time he'd put his fist through a wall. The first had been at an FM house dance party when he'd seen Zena grind dancing with a senior, flaunting herself in front of him. We'd chosen our majors at the same time. Mine was English language and literature. His, molecular biophysics and biochemistry. Because of friends on the track team as well as Rob, I felt relatively in sync with the black community and would regularly show up at the FM house dances to be schooled on how to move my hips from side to side without over-involving the shoulders, how to lose or at least soften my white man's overbite and the irresistible tendency to snap my fingers with the beat. Those friends called me De Jeff, and like Rob had once done with Hitovoy Dundovic on water polo bus rides, goaded me to belt out the lyrics to songs like Shake Yo Ass. I was a source of amusement and happy to dance, literally, in that role, although there was something disingenuous about me being there, like a benign joke we were all in on. I found it far easier to loosen up in that situation than I did with more preppy classmates, among whom existed a pressure to align with a specific kind of humor and overall social effect. The black students of our year anointed themselves the class of O'Deuce, and from time to time a call-and-response chant would break out during a dance party, with one person yelling, "Oh, what?" and the rest of us responding, "Oh, deuce," over and over with vitality and pride. I didn't smoke marijuana at all at the time. I was so obsessed with track, with literally and metaphorically running around in circles for hours each day, that I didn't even permit myself caffeine. Never a part of Rob's stoner group, I lived unassumingly on its fringe. As I began to recognize the faces and names of his more regular customers, we all developed a low-key rapport. sometimes even pausing to converse for a minute or two in the common room before they entered Rob's room to get what they'd come for. I was quick, far too quick, not to mention self-righteous, to judge these people as wasteoids. Though Rob seemed to smoke more than any of them, I somehow never included him in this blanket mental term. But I never dug any deeper than the shallow surface. I never pulled back far enough from my seemingly comprehensive breakfast classes, lunch practice, weight room, dinner, library, sleep schedule, as well as my own perception of how they spent their free time, to consider that each of them, just like Rob, just like me, just like any one of my friends, possessed a 19-year-long story that had culminated in them being here, now at Yale buying pot for my roommate. Raquel Diaz was almost as colorful in dress as she was in attitude, befitting her hometown of Miami, where her Puerto Rican family pronounced the English Y sound as J. And when she'd been accepted to Yale, the house erupted with exclamations of, "Raquel is going to jail! Raquel is going to jail!" She struggled not to project undue symbolism onto the dialectical mishap. A dense tangle of long, reddish-brown, tightly curled hair burst from her scalp at all angles. She was the kind of person around whom you had to be careful about the opinions you expressed, because if she disagreed, she would let you know it. She was like a beautiful, tropical bird, all smooth, placid feathers one moment, and the next a quick-striking chaos of talons and beak. She'd met Rob during the second or third night of college, when she found him stoned to the point of passing out while her friend, a beautiful future actress from Morocco named Lyric Benson, performed something like a belly dance above him. Raquel's father, a Cuban opera singer and santero, had stormed out of their home when she was 6 months old, following a fight with her mother. He'd never returned. Her barrio upbringing had been rife with anxieties similar to those Rob had experienced with a single, poor minority mother. Like Rob, she had controlled these stresses by excelling in sports and academics. However, unlike Rob, Raquel was temperamental and unpredictable, and at Yale she found few socially acceptable means by which to vent her various frustrations. Increasingly, as college wore on, she vented them to Rob, often in the boiler room two stories beneath the college's ground floor, where they met to share a blunt after dinner a few nights a week. While the heavy machines around them pumped heat to a few hundred students above, she found in Rob peace a strange blend of an older brother's strength and a sister's sensitivity that she'd never encountered before. Someone with whom she could just chill and worry less about the tuition installments her mother might not be able to send, and exchange gripes about the people around them without judgment. They were at Yale. They had won, but they both learned the hard way that winning didn't mean they wouldn't encounter problems. Problems that some herb and good company went a long way toward resolving. Daniela Pierce grew up in a biracial family in Oakland, California. She and her mother were white, her father and her two siblings were black, and she'd gone to a predominantly black public high school. In the auditorium on their first day of freshman year, the principal had instructed the students to look at the person sitting on the right and left and understand that one of them would not graduate. This had proven to be the case. She'd left for Yale a few weeks after her high school boyfriend, black, had gone to prison for dealing, and she brought that conflict, among many others, with her. She wore baggy clothes, spoke with urban intonations, and went out exclusively with black men, including Rob, for a minute. Academics were particularly hard for her, and she spent most days feeling unfit to be a part of this student body. She was majoring in psychology, but no matter how many hours she invested, no matter how much extra help she sought, she felt destined to struggle academically. Like many students accustomed to being the smartest kids in suboptimal high schools, she came to Yale and for the first time felt stupid. Also, like many students, pride prevented her from seeking out the infrastructure of tutors the Yale system had in place. Ironically, the affluent kids from prestigious high schools, those who needed it the least, often took the most advantage of these utilities to sharpen their already honed academic skills. But then, while stressing about a test late at night and seriously considering transferring to a California state school, two strong hands would land on her shoulders and begin gently massaging her muscles, and that deep, assuring voice would say, "It's cool, Daniela, it's cool." And in those moments, with Rob standing behind her, she could permit herself to believe, if only fleetingly, that it was. Perhaps the most frequent presence in Rob's room was Oswaldo Gutierrez. He'd grown up in Newark's predominantly Puerto Rican North Ward, in a small, chaotic home owned by his grandparents and populated by transient uncles and cousins. He was slight in stature, but he had a sharpness to him, somewhere in the hard-to-pin layers between his wiry physique and elusive personality. Though he was always polite to me as he ducked beneath my arm that held open the door, he seemed to keep an invisible fence raised around him, complete with a sign that read, "We're fine, but we're not the same, so don't get too close." Oswaldo was, in a word, guarded. An uncle who worked for a Colombian drug cartel was paying his tuition. The disparities between the house he'd grown up in and the towers he now lived in clung to him constantly. He found himself angry all the time, judging his classmates and what he saw as their blithe existences, their wide-open futures that didn't involve taking care of a sprawling, violent, dysfunctional family. In Rob, he found a man who harbored many of the same feelings but was able to do so seamlessly, at least outwardly so, with a smile and some profane but harmless shit talk over a blunt. Rob had many friends. Danny Nelson was technically his boss in the dining hall, a slight student from the Bronx who walked around campus with his earphones in, often alone. From a distance, he looked to be shuffling along gloomily with his head pointed straight down to the ground. But up close, you could see that he was actually dancing in a kind of foxtrot with a subtle smile aimed at no one. Yesenia Vasquez was Oswaldo's girlfriend and an aspiring poet. Nick Crowley, our hallmate freshman year, played on the lacrosse team. Rob had friends from the water polo team, friends from the weed shack, friends from his science classes. Alejandra, Cliff, BJ, Arnaldo, Linda, Maria, Chris, Josh, Candace, Anthony, Pablo, so many names that I eventually ceased keeping track. In contrast to the unnervingly quiet kid with whom I'd first shaken hands in Lamon Wright Hall, Rob was becoming something of a beloved presence on the Yale campus, and not simply because he sold drugs and hung out. He had a natural curiosity about the stories of those around him, paired with a brain that was quick to draw insights from within each of these stories. And Raquel, Daniela, and Oswaldo were the people who became most intimate with his own story. With Raquel, he would talk about family. With Daniela, he would talk about classes. With Oswaldo, he would talk about home. With each of them, he would talk about life, where it was now, where it needed to get, and how to bridge that gap, which sometimes seemed gaping. They'd made it to Yale, but once there, they were all surprised to learn that they hadn't made it, not yet. I respected the fact that these friendships with Rob were far deeper than my own, and I made it a point never to intrude. I was attuned to the worth of each one, and I felt that if I were to make an overt effort to take part, I would be thieving somehow. But still, as time passed and I watched their various bonds strengthen, I felt jealous. I didn't have any real grounds to feel that way, especially since, as a friend, Rob saved me twice sophomore year. The first time was on Halloween. Through a friend who played the flute in the Yale Symphony Orchestra, I'd gotten a job as a bouncer at their annual midnight Halloween show. The atmosphere was more like a Kiss concert. Woolsey Auditorium became a throng of drunk people in elaborate costumes, bodies hanging over the balconies, all waiting anxiously for the curtain to rise on the symphony. It says a lot about Yale that this was one of the most anticipated social events of the year. My job was to make sure no one snuck in the side door to the right of the stage. 100 ticketless students were outside pounding to get in, and I had to make sure no one went out those doors either, because if they pushed them open, the inflowing tide would prove impossible to stop. Fire code violations would surely follow. I took this responsibility seriously, standing in front of the door in a black T-shirt, with my arms crossed and a dour expression intended to convey impassibility. For most of the night, I politely turned back errant and inebriated students, who regarded me as some meddling asshole before turning to seek another exit. Then, a tall, muscular guy, another heavyweight rower, walked toward me with some momentum. I sidestepped to block him. "Sorry, can't go out this way." He ignored me and juked the other way. I blocked him again, this time his chest collided with my still-crossed arms. He backed up 3 steps and barreled toward me. From high school football, I knew how to lower my center of gravity the way Rob once did in the street. We thudded together and I gave no ground. Suddenly his fists were thumping against my chest and shoulders, and I returned in kind, exhilarated by my first collegiate fist fight. Because he was so drunk and I wasn't, I performed adequately, at one point connecting an almost uppercut to his jaw. He ceased bothering with punches and tackled me instead, and we tumbled through the door I'd been enlisted to keep shut, down 5 concrete steps, onto Beniki Plaza. We stood, gathered ourselves. I hollered, "Get him out of here!" But to little effect, because he'd now been joined by 2 rowing teammates, and all 3 were bearing down on me, while the kids who'd been pounding to get in stepped back, amused, reducing my thoughts to, "Oh, fuck, this is going to be embarrassing." Then they stopped. The 2 newcomers put their hands on my combatant's shoulders and pulled him away, and they headed off while he gave me the finger and slurred a few profanities. Thinking my firm countenance had something to do with their retreat, I puffed out my chest, feeling quite the badass. Then I heard Rob behind me, "Damn, son, didn't know you had it in you." From the balcony a few moments before, he'd seen the initial altercation and hurried down. All he'd had to do was stand behind me, feet set and fists clenched, and with what I imagine now to be a taut grin on his face, to send the crew guys packing. He helped me close the door. The incoming stream ceased upon his appearance. "Thanks," I said, pain beginning to settle in the kidney area. "You know I got your back," he replied. The following week, the flutist who'd recruited me left a fruit basket for my efforts. The second time Rob saved me had to do with a girl. She was a freshman on the track team. Her father had, in fact, run track with mine at Yale in the late 60s, and so my mom had prompted me to check in on her during the first week of school. I remembered her vaguely from track team reunions when we'd been children and was surprised to find that she was very beautiful. We saw each other at the track every day, went to a lot of the same parties. She was half black and so could hang out with both demographics. Drunk kissed one night and began dating. I felt very much in love and so fell into the pattern I'd once smirked at in which I tried to pretend that we were married or at least engaged. This behavior carried on, blissfully, I thought, through the first semester. Weekend trips to Manhattan to stroll hand in hand through Central Park. Clothes left in one another's bureaus. "Sweet, I love you," whispered across the pillow while listening to Sade ballads in her bed at night. Then in January, after a friend told her, "Jeff Hobbs, he's like marriage material," she quickly dumped me. Divorced me, I felt, as I fell into a pathetic spiral of self-pity. The breakup was the hardest thing I'd ever experienced in my life. The saddest and most all-consuming. Rob hadn't seemed to think much of it. Maybe he'd made a "fuck them hoes" comment here and there to get my head right. Then a few long weeks later, he'd found me at 2 o'clock on a Saturday night in our common room, having just composed a long, driveling email to her with which I was quite satisfied. "What we had was so special. You'll never find another guy as good as me, blah, blah, blah." Rob looked over my shoulder and understood the gravity of the situation in terms not so much of my feelings, but of my dignity, which at the moment was non-existent. Before I could hit send, my finger reaching for the button, convinced this bunk would bring her hurrying back that very night, he physically pulled my chair away from the desk. Not, he said sternly. "You want to share your feelings with someone? Share them with me." And I did. For 45 minutes, I outlined the complex, I thought again, feelings churning within me, waxing on about the family I wanted to have with this girl. The nice home we'd have in Chatham, New Jersey, where she'd grown up, Chatham being one of the posh commuter towns 10 minutes west of East Orange, and the 3 children we'd raise who would all run track for Yale, and this entire idealized future I'd constructed in my head. He indulged me with patience, sincerity, sans laughter, despite the urge he must have felt to laugh. I asked him if he knew what it was like to have a woman you loved inhabit every single one of your waking thoughts and most of your dreams. "Yeah," he replied soberly, "I do." He kept nodding with appropriate sympathy, even as he informed me that I was acting like a girl in every way. Then he said, "Jeff, you're a good dude, too good to be bothering with this bullshit." I nodded glumly. "I'm going to fix you up with someone fine. Stay tuned." He did, and that helped, and I slowly recovered from what had seemed at the time to be a cataclysmic, irreparable heartbreak. Epilogue. I did end up hitting the send button after Rob went to bed, and needless to say, the email did not accomplish what it had been designed to. When Rob learned this, he fell onto the couch and laughed his ass off. Molecular biophysics and biochemistry was not for the faint of heart. Embedded within an expanse of various sciences, chemistry, geology, engineering, astrophysics, etc., MB&B garnered, on average, 25 students per class out of 500 to 600 total science majors. For pre-meds, the most common major was Intercellular Molecular and Developmental Biology, IMDB, which was basically an elevated extension of high school biology. For those planning on medical school, a primary goal of these classes was to get good grades, good MCAT scores, and acceptances to good med schools. Students and advisors designed curricula around these ends, and so most students steered far clear of MB&B and its many dizzying prerequisites: advanced calculus, theoretical physics, physical chemistry, commonly known to be the hardest course of all the Yale sciences, as well as each of the core classes that the IMDB majors took. Those who majored in MB&B were either smart and confident enough to know they would get A's anyway, or sufficiently interested in the subject not to worry about their GPAs. Rob was both. His classmates at Yale, as his classmates had at St. Benedict's, knew him as a guy who would sit in the back of the class, often looking stoned or simply bored, taking notes but rarely speaking. Then, when the time came to take a test or give an individual presentation, he would kill it, making the others wonder what they were doing wrong. Because of its immense difficulty, MB&B was in some ways free of the hyper-competitiveness that prevailed in the various pre-med tracks. I'd gotten a small dose of this freshman year when I took intro biology. From English classes, I was already well accustomed to students talking tediously regarding their keen insights into the Canterbury Tales or Pope's The Rape of the Lock, leaning back with legs crossed and eyes pointed upwards as if divining their words from on high, but I'd never before experienced the thickly layered pressure of a Yale science lecture hall, during which a few hundred students craned forward while writing every word uttered by the professor, sometimes recording on MP3 players as well. The atmosphere was stifling, more uncomfortable than the chairs in the lecture hall, which themselves were particularly narrow and lacking legroom in order to accommodate the masses. You could almost sense a shortage of oxygen in the air, as well as a collective constriction of the lungs consuming that oxygen. These students felt that their futures were at stake in each class and each test, and one missed word, 1 minute less spent drilling the textbook pages, could mean the difference between Harvard Medical School and someplace lesser, like, say, Vanderbilt. As a result of this experience, the only other science class I took to fulfill graduation requirements was Geology 101, otherwise known as Rocks for Jocks. Rob didn't give any ground to the anxiety coursing through the students around him. He simply went to class, did his work, got A's. That he did so while smoking and dealing copious amounts of marijuana only made him more of a marvel. He wasn't just smart, he was cool. Rob would have said that the weed and the grades were directly related, because being high helped him study free from the nervousness that racked his peers. He chose the MB&B track mainly out of curiosity. He wanted to know how things worked, and MB&B spanned everything from the most intricate proteins within the human body to the working of the cosmos over billions of years. Think Stephen Jay Gould and Stephen Hawking designing a college major together. The choice of major spoke to what Rob had put last on his high school yearbook list of favorites: knowledge. He liked to say, almost dreamily, that there were more chemical interactions taking place in the human body each second than there were stars in the universe. He and Oswaldo started a small study group together, more or less a science club. Once a week, as Rob had done with the Burger Boys in high school, he, Oswaldo, and a few others gathered to talk about science. Unlike in high school, his task here was not to catch his friends up, but rather to immerse himself in what interested them and to discuss the long-term applications of their schoolwork, whether it was med school or a PhD or working in a lab. They talked about the financial repercussions of each option, particularly vital to Rob and Oswaldo, both of whom carried with them the expectation of providing immediately for their families upon graduation. Med school had the biggest long-term upside, but the amount of debt one had to take on in the short term, mid-six figures for a top school, was intimidating. A PhD program led to a teaching career, but that meant living in the petty, racially complicated world of academia forever. Lab work was perhaps the most intellectually fulfilling, but options were limited, as was the prospect of making any real money. Because they were just sophomores when they started the group, the life talk could remain cozily abstract. They still had plenty of time to figure it all out. Mostly, they reveled in having a safe environment in which to fully celebrate their nerddom, which for all their lives, on the streets of Newark certainly, but also in unexpected ways at Yale, they'd been compelled to camouflage. As word of the study group leaked and more students began trying to join, kids Rob didn't know as well, he began to disengage from it. Early junior year, he stopped coming altogether. At the same time, he began working in a lab at Yale Medical School, headed by a famed molecular chemistry professor, performing research under the guidance of two PhD students. He began as a lab assistant, sterilizing beakers, recording data, getting coffee. Because of his disciplined promptness and curiosity, he quickly graduated to running his own low-level experiments, primarily in crystal diffraction. His work mostly involved trial and error, and he failed more often than he succeeded in achieving the desired results. His experiments dealt in the scope of atoms, one too many or one too few, and the reactions fell apart. But unlike most other realms of his life, in a lab with sufficient funding, he could always go back to the beginning and try again, which he did with the determination that had the graduate students above him fearing for their jobs. Social life, academics, lab work, the days and weeks and months, and ultimately the years passed with an increasing fluidity. Whether he identified with his chosen university or not, the truth was that Rob Peace was a Yalie, and he seemed to grow more comfortable with his status as such. At points along the way, we sometimes wondered how much money he was actually making selling weed. Hundreds of dollars a month? Thousands? More? Maybe? We couldn't keep track of the customer traffic coming in and out. We did know that Yale students would pay whatever he asked, no haggling. We knew that every other weekend he would make a trip to Newark, sometimes just for the day, and return with 2-gallon-sized Ziplocs of pot in his backpack to carry him through until the next re-up. He was always in a good mood upon his return, as if nourished. We knew that each night he spent 15 minutes or so with his ledger and, as he'd done with menial jobs during childhood, kept careful track of money he'd made, money he expected to make, money he needed to outlay. We knew that he'd quit his dining hall job and worked in the lab for free. We knew that he sold pot to townies, grad students, and even professors in addition to classmates. We knew that his business seemed to steadily ratchet upward from month to month, and that this was the main reason he lobbied us to move into an apartment junior year, a 2-bedroom still paid for in tuition as university housing, but located in an apartment building across the street from Pearson College proper, outside the gates and, so technically, off campus. What we didn't know, we didn't ask, and instead made assumptions. He must be sending money home to his mother. He was saving for graduate school. He kept everything on the DL or down low. He knew exactly what he was doing. Oswaldo felt differently, and he didn't keep his opinions from Rob the way most everyone else did. Unlike many of our classmates who bought from him, Oswaldo didn't see anything cool or thug about dealing drugs. Dealing to him, as it had been to Rob's father, was a practical matter of economics, of calculating and compensating for shortfalls. As such, you had to be smart. And a smart dealer didn't work out of his Yale dorm room. He didn't carry Ziplocs of weed in his backpack across campus. He didn't prop the entryway door open with a phone book so that he wouldn't have to get off his lazy ass to let customers in. Oswaldo had been dealing, too. After his cartel-associated uncle was put in prison, his assets were frozen and thus unavailable for tuition payments. But Oswaldo was quiet about it. He worked off campus and in small quantities, just enough to help out. He also maintained a work-study job in the library. Oswaldo was flummoxed by the fact that his friend could be so quiet, almost embarrassed about his academic acumen, yet so damn loud and proud of his status as a premier campus drug dealer. "I've never met anyone so smart but so fucking dumb," he told Rob. Rob just shrugged, laughed, and replied, "Don't worry about me." Less skeptical were Victor, Tavris, and Flowey, each of whom visited a number of times. Victor came the most often, busing down from Daniel Webster 2 or 3 times a year. His older brother, Big Steve, when he got up from the couch, the springs failed to rise with him, would come up from New Jersey. They seemed like smart guys, kind, easygoing, and non-confrontational. They did not fit the mold of the stock characters I imagined him hanging out with on his Newark trips, where I envisioned the re-up transactions occurring on dark, barren sidewalks in the middle of the night. They were always smiling and laughing, usually over a blunt and a 1.5-liter bottle of E&J. They carried no cynicism or condescension regarding Yale. They seemed, above all, proud of their friend for being here. They would listen to music in the room with little interest in recruiting girls to join, always inclusive of me and Ty. Dan left our quad after sophomore year, considering that he lived physically in the bedroom where Rob kept his stock and entertained his friends. I didn't blame him. Rob told him that I had pull with girls, an utter lie that I gladly played along with. Their visits were just like any visits between high school friends on a college campus. Booze, weed, empty pizza boxes littering the floor beneath bodies passed out on the couch. Big Steve typically vomited at some point, and because of his immense size, it could be difficult for him to make it to the bathroom in time. The pizza boxes, it turned out, did not make for adequate receptacles. One night, sophomore year, they returned to the room, swearing and hyped up with rage. Rob had a large black welt on his forehead. I asked what happened. "Some fool just hit me in the street, turned tail and ran away," Rob growled. "Who?" "Don't know, wasn't a Yaley." "Why'd he do it?" I asked, thinking of my own comical fistfight, knowing that I was incapable of producing a bruise like that on a man while visualizing the kind of person who could. Thought I was someone else. I believe the story of mistaken identity, and I participated in their collective anger. "We should find a guy," I said, thinking that this was the thing you said in this situation, but definitely not thinking that the three of them would put their coats back on and head for Victor's car to troll the streets of New Haven, looking for retribution. Unlike Ty, unlike most anyone I'd ever known, Rob wasn't in the business of chest thumping. Words for him meant deeds. Otherwise, he would just be fronting. "You coming?" he asked. The writer in me wanted to go, as here was an opportunity to cross boundaries somehow, as well as prove to my friend that I was real. But the sheltered college student was terrified of the prospect manifesting in their narrow, glaring eyes. Very rarely, real violence had infiltrated the campus. There'd been a gang-related shootout at the intersection of York and Chapel Streets the year before. Every few months, a student walking alone at night on the edge of campus was mugged or even beaten. There'd been a heavily publicized stabbing death a few months earlier, along with bulletins that warned us to walk in groups after dark, know where the blue-lit emergency phones were, stay on campus at all times. I did go with them, pride ultimately trumping good sense. In Victor's old Lincoln, we drove widening concentric circles around campus. That there was no way we'd ever find this guy became quickly apparent, a relief to me. And yet hours passed quietly, elongated, each of us peering out at the deserted streets and darkened, crooked, clapboard houses, in which most of the population of New Haven, aside from the 5,000 Yale undergrads, lived. Rob would slow the car when we passed small groups of men on the sidewalk, studying each of their faces until one of them invariably turned and spread his arms and said, "The fuck you want?" At around 3:30, long after what we were doing had become more of a ritual than an actual undertaking, I murmured, "Hey, Rob, doesn't seem like we're going to find this asshole. Maybe we should just head back to campus?" He gingerly fingered the welt on his head and replied, "Yeah, getting low on gas anyway, motherfucker." On that night, and on all the less eventful others, I was envious of the degree to which these three men knew each other, their shared history and easy way of spending a weekend together, as if no time at all had separated these visits, and the understated yet automatic way they had one another's backs. I had never had a male friendship like that. I couldn't even conceive of how to build one. Though I didn't understand this at the time, the fact was that it hadn't been built. Like the organic compounds Rob worked with in the lab, their friendship had evolved over time, experience, and an inexorable atomic pull. They called each other brother, and in the context from which they came, a brother was someone who would die for you. Not as a verbal phrasing meant to suggest a deep kinship, but an actual fact, should the need arise. Tavris and Flowey were more guarded when they came just once during AFAM week of junior year. Their offishness may have had to do with their circumstances at the time. Tavris had just dropped out of college and was back in Newark, living with his brother in a rundown apartment above and beneath Section 8 recipients and neighboring a significant drug den. He was trying to get his foot in the real estate business, building off that high school job doing title research. His poor grades and dropout status from 2 years of college did not aid him. Flowey had torn two ligaments in his knee when he'd slipped lifeguarding, and he hadn't worked in a month. They were both in one of life's ebbs, unsure about anything, wondering how they'd been riding such promising trajectories at St. Benedict's just 2.5 years before. They must have experienced some reserve in seeing Rob with his towers of books, his spacious, paid-for apartment, his thriving business, his white roommate with the crew cut and Yale track and field t-shirts, his stable of female friends who happily came by to spend 3 hours rebraiding his cornrows just for the pleasure of his company. With melancholy faces, they spent the afternoon in our living room, arms folded and shoulders hunched, as if they'd been called into the Master of Discipline's office at St. Benedict's. They were polite enough, but no effort of mine could extend a conversation past 2 or 3 exchanges. Chloe spoke in a quiet mumble, without spaces between his words, and with something like a southern twang. I couldn't really understand him anyway. Because of AFAM week, parties were happening everywhere, and the racial mix of crowds on the quads was, for this long weekend, evenly split between white and black. I stayed in to read, and I was in my underwear, brushing my teeth, when they returned, and Rob said, "About to be a couple people rolling through," as he picked stray clothes off the couch. Chloe and Tavris, as opposed to earlier, were now giddy and active after the 4 hours they'd spent out. They cycled through the CDs fanned across the top of our stereo, some of which were mine, albums by the Wallflowers and Faith No More that rarely made it onto the air in our room. Suddenly, Throw Dem Boys by Ludacris, a hard-driving song with its own dance that I knew and liked, was playing at full volume. The door was open and people were streaming through, and not just a couple as Rob had advertised. A dozen, then two, then three, until the apartment was jammed, mostly with strangers from other schools. Daniela Pierce was the only other white person. I was still in my underwear, more or less hiding in the bedroom Ty and I shared. Rob Tavris and Flowey were in the middle of the room, throwing bows, with the bass line like a black urban version of the chicken dance. To them, this moment must have recalled that party at Columbia High School, when everyone had followed them to the dance and they'd felt like the absolute center of the world. I tried to hang out, but the situation was overwhelming. Short on familiar faces, and with all the noise and crowd, there were probably another 40 people outside the apartment building waiting to get in. I had no doubt that the campus police would show up eventually. And if the campus police were to show up in our room, smell the weed inside, enter and look around, open Rob's lower right desk drawer or his black trunk. For the first time, our room didn't feel safe to me. And it felt less so when Rob caught me as I was leaving, gestured toward my laptop on the desk, and said, "You probably should put that away if you want it to still be here tomorrow." The cops did show up, I learned the next day. Rob had known they would, but he'd also known, or so he claimed, that all they would do was disperse the crowd outside, tell him to turn the music down and keep the front door of the building shut. Any further action would have caused undue racial tension, which had happened many times before during AFAM week, and which, or so he claimed, Yale was in a constant state of trying to avoid. He was so happy during those weekends with his boys, carefree and kinetic, exhibiting a pride that was rare to observe in him and elevated by the pride his friends had for him. His attitude in their presence resembled mine during Parents' Weekend, eager to show off the life he had carved out of this place and his ownership of that life. And while he played down certain aspects of Yale, the girls were generally unattractive, the guys were stuck up, most of the parties were lame as hell, he relished the brief windows he was able to give the East Orange set into New Haven, or New Slaven, as he sometimes called our adopted city. But the happiest I ever saw Rob in college wasn't when his friends visited. He traveled to Costa Rica during the summer after sophomore year. In addition to his custodial job cleaning up campus after graduation, the lab work that continued into the summer and a month on Chapman Street with Jackie, he'd gone to visit a friend, an international student at Yale. When school began again, I asked him how the trip had gone. He folded his hands behind his head and looked up toward the ceiling, not smiling exactly, but with a far-flung expression, a shedding of anxiety so total that he might have been a Buddhist monk at the door of Nirvana. He told me about smoking a blunt alone on a black sand beach on the Pacific Ocean. I hiked through 3 miles of jungle to the beach. The sand was so soft, so fine, volcanic. The water blue like you've never seen blue before, sky, mountains. And I rolled a blunt and just sat there for hours alone, and it was so damn peaceful. That trip inspired a passion for travel that would underlie the rest of his life and in college lead him to begin planning a post-graduation trip to Rio de Janeiro, which research and word of mouth had led him to see as the perfect balance between urban and scenic and cultural pleasures. The first thing he did, 2 years in advance, was begin taking Portuguese classes so he could speak the language. But before that trip, he had to graduate. The certainty of that event was shaken severely when the master of Pearson College called Rob into his office to address the not small matter of the drugs he'd been selling. Chapter 8. Drugs. The unlawful possession, use, purchase, or distribution of illicit drugs or controlled substances, including stimulants, depressants, narcotics, or hallucinogenic drugs. The misuse of prescription drugs, including sharing, procuring, buying, or using in a manner different from the prescribed use, or by someone other than the person for whom it was prescribed. This entry in Yale's undergraduate regulations fell under the list of infractions punishable by expulsion, as ruled by the executive committee, a group of 7 faculty members and 3 undergraduates responsible for the fair, consistent, and uniform enforcement of the undergraduate regulations. As Rob entered the Pearson master's office in February of his junior year, he was fairly certain that he was walking into an arraignment of sorts, which would be followed by a conjoined trial, judgment, and sentencing under the committee. Whereas his father's conviction had taken 3 years, he figured his would take in the vicinity of 3 weeks. Then he would be gone. The block is hot. The expression was used in the drug trade, meaning that the police were sniffing around. Not to an extent that should cause panic, but a warning to be alert. Rob had said these words, lightly, when I'd found him rifling through his belongings a few days earlier. His black trunk was open in the middle of the room, and he was packing it with bongs, bowls, one-hitters, weed, ledgers, and cash as his pet python named Dio meandered lazily around the mulch carpet of its glass tank. He'd bought the 2-foot reptile in the fall. Every week or so, I would drive him to a pet store 10 minutes away for snake food— a live mouse. I'd watched Dio's very first feeding with Rob and Ty like a live Discovery Channel show. Rob dropped the mouse into the tank, and the snake let it exist for a few minutes, just hanging out behind a small log while the rodent frantically pawed at the glass wall. When Dio did decide to move, the act happened fast, a quick, precise strike that kicked up mulch and ended with the mouse, a white, adorable little thing wrapped tightly in 2 coils of Dio's body, asphyxiating, one of its eyeballs loose from its socket. The actual ingestion that followed was grotesquely prolonged, Dio's jaws dislocating to encompass 5 or 6 times their normal span, the mouse passing through them in slow millimeter increments. Rob watched the entire process, silently, hypnotized. Afterward, the snake didn't move for days as the lump inched down its body by way of peristalsis. "What are you going to do with all your stuff?" I asked, speaking of the black trunk being packed tight with drug paraphernalia. "Taking it to a friend's." He didn't seem too worried, certainly not enough to make me worry. The relocation of incriminating items was just precautionary. This had happened once before sophomore year, and the police had never come. No one came this time either. What did come was a letter with a red warning stripe on the envelope and a message 3 sentences long. "Dear Robert, you are hereby required to meet in the master's office tomorrow afternoon at 4 p.m. If you have standing obligations, a note can be acquired from the master's office excusing you. Please be advised that this is an important matter, and failure to appear will result in immediate disciplinary action." So they knew about his dealing, and the fact that he'd received a formal letter rather than an email suggested that they meant business. Most likely, a customer he didn't know well had been caught smoking and betrayed the source. Or maybe Oswaldo had been right and Rob had been too cocky, had just assumed that because he'd never been in trouble, he never would. Either way, he was out. The master's office was directly across the street from our apartment building, no more than 20 steps away. After walking hundreds or even thousands of miles through the dangerous streets of East Orange in the course of his life, after spending dozens of hours on Metro North trains with a backpack full of drugs, those 20 steps must have been the most anxious of Rob's life. What would he do once he was expelled? He would have to tell Raquel, Daniela, Danny, and Oswaldo, friends who had depended on him to get them through their own harried Yale years. He would have to tell Jacinta in the dining hall, who knew what he did and had constantly warned him to stay safe. He would have to tell Charles Cawley, to whom he'd been sending his transcripts following each semester, with handwritten notes describing his experiences and continuing gratitude. He would have to tell Jackie and subject her to yet another phone call at work, during which she would learn that the most important man in her life had failed her. He must have been thinking about these conversations as he entered the office and waited in one of the three wooden chairs alongside students there to drop a class or apply for a part-time job. Then the receptionist told him to go in. The master of Pearson College was a short, bald, Slavic literature professor. He was considered one of the coolest masters, both because of his patient manner that had helped uncountable numbers of students endure the various pressures they felt Yale placed on them, and because of the annual Jell-O wrestling match he took part in on the Pearson Quad. The dean of Pearson College was a petite woman with a sharp German accent whose job it was to handle things like class schedules, academic conflicts, and discipline. Both had always been kind to Rob and checked in with him often over the years. Too often, he sometimes complained, as if they felt he needed extra attention for some reason. Rob slung his backpack over the chair and sat. He said hello to each of them politely and waited for his due. The meeting lasted 20 minutes, and Rob said very little. The administrators took turns speaking about the seriousness of this infraction, the short and long-term consequences, the fact that Rob was such a talented guy, so intelligent, so much better than what he was doing. The master focused on the emotional aspect of it, the disservice Rob was doing himself, the opportunity he was squandering. The dean spoke about the institutional side, the Yale ideals Rob had betrayed, the damage it could cause both other students and the university itself. Rob didn't deny anything. He didn't cite financial strain as an excuse. He didn't explode with self-righteous indignation as he had done with Coach Ridley. He nodded his head and kept saying, "Yes, yes, yes." In the end, they asked him to give his assurance under the honor code of Yale University that he would stop dealing drugs entirely. "Yes," he replied one more time, and he thanked them for their guidance and discretion. He finished by saying, "I'm sorry." They let him go. There would be no executive committee hearing. There would be no police. There would be no expulsion. And Rob went straight to water polo practice, for which he was 30 minutes late. Rather than dampen Rob's growing air of untouchability, this brush with authority only elevated it. "It looks bad for the university if someone like me goes down like that," he told Oswaldo the following night with a grin and a shrug. "They don't want to mess around with it." They were in Oswaldo's room in Trumbull College, a Gothic building next to the library. Oswaldo was flustered, bordering on angry. Exactly what he had warned his friend would happen had happened, and yet here was Rob in his leather coat, acting like the man when he should have been preparing to present his transgressions before the executive committee. "Get the fuck out of my room," Oswaldo said. "I have to study." "Damn," replied Rob. "Chill, I'm gonna keep it on the down low for a minute." "I can't deal with your dumb shit anymore," Oswaldo said. "You do dumb shit, and you know it's dumb shit, but it's the same dumb shit you grew up around, so you do it anyway. I'm done." Oswaldo was dealing with his own shit. In fact, shit that would land him in a white room in Yale's psychiatric institute a few weeks later. His brain had begun to crumble under the weight it had to bear. His spiraling family in Newark, his affluent, oblivious classmates whose constant whining about how hard their lives were made him want to turn a gun on them. The daily financial planning involved in keeping up with his tuition payments and the growing debt load in his name, the ever-approaching moment when graduation came, and he would be faced with trying to keep his life moving upward, and all of this before he even cracked a textbook to study for his 400-level psychology curriculum. Fantasies of turning a gun on the people around him evolved into turning a gun on his forehead, and suddenly he found himself walking around another region of New Haven in the middle of the night, struggling to recall his own name, let alone what he was doing here, in the grip of a full-fledged psychotic break. Luckily, his girlfriend had sensed that something was wrong, notified his dean, master, and campus police, and they were able to find him. Rob visited him in the psychiatric ward almost every day and sat across a table from him in a monitored room for as long as he was permitted. Excursions that were similar to a prison visit in purely physical ways. The security checkpoints, the cameras affixed to the ceiling, the bolted metal doors, the space between you and the person sitting across from you just a few feet, and yet signifying so much more. Rob would look at his short, rail-thin friend, the friend who had always counseled him wisely, if not patiently, and whose counsel he'd refused to take. Now, that friend was twitchy and not making much sense at all. Rob would just nod and give him a general update of what was happening on campus and say, "Trust me, you're not missing anything." His staidness, paired with the ability to not treat Oswaldo like a psychiatric patient, sparing him both the hesitancy of speech and overenthusiastic bursts of innocuous information that visits from